The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to welcome you all to the Gold Dome Scramble, our weekly checkup of the Georgia General Assembly. I'm Lisa Ram, and right now I kind of want to do like this. I want to throw up my papers the lawmakers did last night, but we'll leave that to them. The 2021 session of the General Assembly ended last night, roughly around midnight, and here's how it came to a close in the Senate. Listen to this.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The ayes have it. The Senate stands adjourned. Sign it out.
Some excited and probably pretty exhausted senators right there. To find out what passed and what didn't, I am joined today by several of my colleagues. There are the regulars, Emil Moffitt and Emma Hurd, who have joined me week after week after week. Welcome, both of you. Good to see you after a long, exhausting session, wasn't it? Yeah, you did it. Bravo to both of you for covering from beginning to end. But also, I'd like to bring in three other of my colleagues who also covered the legislature. Education reporter Martha Dalton, environment reporter Molly Samuel, and Sam Whitehead, our health reporter. Thank you all for stopping by today. Sam, Martha, and Molly, they're going to duck out for just a minute, but I promise you they're going to come back. All right, so would you say we have a lot to cover? First, I want to see, how are you two feeling? I mean, it was 40 days like all the other sessions, but this one was a little exhausting, wasn't it? Emma, begin with you. How are you feeling the day after?
I think, well, it's sort of crazy because it's not just the session, right? We're all coming off of this crazy 2020 election cycle because we've been covering that before the session, and it all has bled together, especially with the voting law taking such a prominent place. It feels like one large blob of a time. I don't even know what time it is anymore, what time of the year. So I think that's what's weird about it, is it feels like this large extended session just because of all that politics that came before.
Yeah, a little more exhausting than last year. You know, they stopped and started. Emil, how are you feeling this round?
Feeling good, yeah. Like Emma said, it was just a long, it felt like going back to early voting in October, from October until now, it's just been one long, felt like an election, a lot of talk about voting. And you know, the lawmakers were tested a couple of times during the session per week. And they were really able to mitigate any sorts of large outbreaks and able to keep things going throughout the course of the session. It kind of waxed and waned as far as the number of lobbyists that were there. And it wasn't as crowded at some points at times at the Capitol this year, but definitely toward the end, it started to fill in again. And we started to kind of have that low rumble in the halls of the Capitol that we're used to.
Well, we appreciate you all keeping us abreast of everything week to week. We have a lot to cover this episode. And, you know, it ended with a jolt, Emma, as you know. A lot of bills being rushed through. But yesterday, the voting laws just really took precedent, even though it was passed a week earlier, right?
Yeah, it's just crazy that is still the number one topic that we're talking about, even though it's already law. Normally, when it's law, we sort of move on to the next bill. But what happened was two of Georgia's most prominent companies yesterday decided to come out with these really strong statements against the law, and it really caught Republican lawmakers by surprise. It was Delta and Coca-Cola in particular. There were other companies around the country, but those are the hometown guys, and that really hit home for these lawmakers, because especially with Delta, they said, look, Delta was at the table with us. We talked to them about this bill. They never voiced such strong objections before. And Delta CEO said, you know, our position evolved after speaking to leaders in the Black community. But for Republicans, it felt like a bit of a betrayal. Mm-hmm. And so they reacted. And we had an attempt, a last minute attempt in the House, literally, I think it was like 11:30 p.m., maybe 11:45. I can't remember, to get rid of Delta's fuel tax credit, which saves it tens of millions of dollars a year. And the House did pass that. The Senate didn't pick it up, so it didn't become law. But it was a warning shot for sure at Delta, saying that wasn't okay, y'all. We're not cool with that. Mm-hmm. And I actually have tape of Speaker Ralston talking about that after the session, saying, you know, basically stating exactly why they did it and how he feels about it.
You know, they like our public policy when we're doing things that benefit them. And so, you know, they reap the reward of that benefit and then turn around and do this. And so, as all of you know, I can't resist a country boy line or two. You know, you don't feed a dog that bites your hand, you know, so got to keep that in mind sometimes.
Coca-Cola was also involved in this. And I heard, I don't know if this is true, but was he walking around drinking Pepsi?
So it's funny. He said in that gaggle, he was like, you know, I tried a Pepsi earlier today. And that is like, that is sacrilegious. I mean, can you ever imagine a Georgia politician saying that at any time? He was drinking a Dasani, which is a Coca-Cola product.
Right.
As we were talking, he was like, oh, well, they just gave me this. But, you know, I tried a Pepsi. It wasn't half bad. So
really sending a message there. Emil, what was the sentiment that you were hearing about this? Because, again, it almost overshadowed all of the action that was taking place yesterday.
It really did. It was still hanging in the air. There were still demonstrators on both sides of the voting issue around the Capitol yesterday. We saw lots of signs. We saw it was brought down a little bit by the fact that you had so much rain at the Capitol yesterday. Some of the outside protests did not go on as planned. But you could definitely still feel this sense of tension in the air really before the voting bills took place and passed as far as the votes go. It was more of a normal session. And then after that, there was a lot more tension in the air amongst lawmakers. So I think it really did kind of to take the air a little bit out of the session when that happened. But like as Emma mentioned, it's just a very unusual sight to see Republican lawmakers who are usually so pro-business really taking it to some of these larger companies in Atlanta and in Georgia that have spoken out about the voting bill.
But I will just add, it's not the first time. And Lisa, I don't know if you remember this, the first time that fuel tax credit has been politicized, right? I mean, Delta got it yanked temporarily after it broke ties with the NRA back in 2015, I think, and they got it back. So there is a bit of history of this kind of push-pull, abusive relationship. I don't know what you want to call it between these two.
This time, though, in the mix, the boycotts, talk of the boycotts and the lawsuits. Any word from Governor Kemp yesterday about all this that was taking place on the 40th day?
Yeah, I mean, Governor Kemp came out strongly immediately after Delta's statement saying this does not reflect what we heard from Delta when we talked to them many times. And that really these new comments contradict that. And, please speak to specifics of the bill. That was his main message yesterday. Was he went on different news networks trying to say they're speaking broadly about it. Let's talk about specifics because they were in the room as we were negotiating. Some of those specifics was the thrust of his message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 40 days, and the only thing lawmakers really needed to do, despite all of this that was going on around them, was to pass a budget. And they did just that. What, $27.2 billion, Emil? A pretty huge one. And a lot of people are going to get fed off of this, correct?
That's right. They passed that $27 billion budget with just about 40 minutes to spare in last night's session. So they were able to do that. It relies quite heavily on federal relief dollars in terms of the relief and recovery from COVID. So there's definitely a lot of dependence on the federal money for that. Of course, coming out of the large stimulus plan passed in Washington. But they do, the state lawmakers did invest about $1 billion in construction projects over the next year. It does restore about 60% of the education funds that were cut out of last year's budget. And if you'll remember, last year at this time, we were talking about 10% across the board cuts, and a lot of those have been restored. Some people would like to see more of that restored because they're saying, hey, we got all this federal money. Let's make sure we shore up our infrastructure and everything as far as the state money goes. It gives about $10 million in that budget to restart the tourism economy here in Georgia, which of course has been hit hard with people not traveling because of the pandemic. And then gives raises for some state employees, including state prison employees and Department of Driver Services employees, some of those ones who had to go into work every day, regardless of pandemic or not. And then about $7.5 million for nursing home facilities as well, as of course they were hit hard during the course of this pandemic as well. So that's what lawmakers had to do, and they barely did it just in time at the end of the 40-day session last night.
Work expands to the time allotted. So I'm going to say on the budget.
Minutes. I mean, they really were cutting it close this time. The federal money, the federal dollars, the relief money, it's up to the governor to pass that money out the way he sees fit? Is that how it stands now?
It's my understanding that the governor, that the state gets some, and also the counties get some directly as well from the federal government. So the state will probably have the lion's share of it to dole out across projects. And of course, we had that hubbub earlier in the session about whether states could pass tax cuts and still get the full allotment of federal relief dollars. And it eventually came down that you could, as long as you weren't trying to pay for those tax cuts with the federal relief dollars. So that kind of that controversy kind of fell away as we got more clarity from the Treasury Department.
All right. A huge chunk going to education. Of course, we'll hear from Martha and even the healthcare. So Sam can chime in on that in a few minutes. Emma, any surprises? You know, gun rights expansion was in play, and Speaker Rawson just didn't think it was the time. Can you go into that a little bit and tell us how lawmakers finished the session and what their sentiment was in the end?
Yeah, that was a last minute surprise on gun rights. We were all kind of watching that. It needed one more stamp of approval, and it didn't happen. And Speaker Rawson was pretty clear. He said he thought it ran out of time. He didn't feel like he had time to properly review it. But he also said, look, just the timing with these recent shootings that we've seen in Atlanta and elsewhere in the country he didn't feel right about that timing. He left the door open for, you know, the bill to become law next year. Because remember, this is a 2-year session. So all these things that we are sort of dead are only temporarily dead. They can all very much come back to life next year. Another surprise was an HIV criminal justice reform bill that did not actually get final approval. It almost did. It had almost unanimous support in the House and the Senate, but there was language added in at the last minute that was related to THC oil that held it up. I haven't quite figured out exactly why. It was so last minute, late at night. Not everybody actually even knows what happened, which is something that also happens on sign e die. People don't necessarily sometimes know what they're voting on or exactly what happened. But this is a reform package that would really modernize the state's criminal code related to those living with HIV. So right now, you can go to jail for up to 10 years for donating blood, sharing a needle, or even having sex with someone if you have HIV and you don't disclose that. And it just really doesn't reflect modern science. And so this is an overhaul of that. But activists are hopeful that, okay, we did all the hard work. We have bipartisan support. Next year, we can get that technicality out of the way.
They've been at that for some time. Emil, what about you? Any real surprises coming out of the session for you? I know you followed everything very closely and nothing took you by surprise there. But in the end, you know, the way lawmakers decided on any particular issues.
Yeah, there was a bill during the session that would allow for these leadership committees from both parties to raise money for members of the General Assembly while they were in session. It would be like the governor and the leaders of each party could raise funds during the session, which has been outlawed for decades and decades. And that actually ended up passing and is on the governor's desk. But there was also a separate bill, and an amendment was put onto it by a senior Republican in the Senate who said that it's a bad look to raise money during the session because you could have lobbyist influence on bills, on passage of bills. And so, but that amendment was never voted on. So that won't happen. And the other bill will go forward to the governor's desk. We did see the repeal of the state citizens arrest law, which was a bipartisan effort, of course, in the response to Ahmaud Arbery's killing last year, in which that was used as a defense for the three men who were accused of his murder. And that's now gone. It does have some carve outs for business owners, shopkeepers who witness a theft or something like that. They can detain somebody, but you can't use deadly force to protect property, according to this law. It can only be if you are facing that threat yourself. Sports betting was a big thing that we expected.
Wah. Sorry, I just feel like we talk about it. We've talked about it so much.
It didn't happen.
And what happens to it? What happened? Yeah.
And sports betting. At the beginning of the session, it looked like it might be able to pass even without a constitutional amendment. And then they kind of got more clarity on that and said, it'll be easier to pass if you have a constitutional amendment along with it. So that's the route they went. They got approval in the Senate, but then they got to the House. And like Emma said, they just didn't have the votes. And because it's a combination, it wasn't a party line thing. There are conservatives in the House who just do not want gambling expanded in the state of Georgia. There are Democrats in the House who feel like the profits and the proceeds from sports betting would not benefit everyone equally in the state. There was also some talk that they were kind of holding that hostage, if you will, for some leverage on other bills because they did have a lot of power with regards to sports betting. But like Emma said, this is something that and Speaker Ralston said it last night, this is something that will definitely come up next January.
I was going to say, it's going to come up again, isn't it?
Yeah. And the referendum on the constitutional referendum would be on the ballot in November of 2022. So it could still possibly pass next year and still be on the ballot kind of in the same timeline. We just wouldn't have the big buildup for a year and a half. We would just have a few months before that constitutional amendment would be on the ballot.
Would you say the citizens arrest repeal is the banner legislation, something that all of them are all lawmakers on both sides are proud of?
I would say as from a bipartisan perspective, that would be the one like we saw with Stand Your Ground last year that both sides can point to and say this is something that they accomplished together.
And, you know, we'll expect probably a kind of prominent signing ceremony from the governor on that because of that, but maybe not for a minute because this partisan rancor over the voting law has really changed the tone. Remember, we sort of had the citizens arrest moment in February and then things devolved in terms of partisan.
Hopefully he won't do it behind closed doors either.
I don't think this one would be signed behind closed doors. The governor wants everybody there. Yeah.
For sure.
To share in that moment. It's a big moment for the state.
Exactly. All right. Thank you guys for your perspective. You're going to stick around for some more. We're going to take a break here, but I want to tell you, the audience, we didn't officially welcome you. We want to officially welcome you. We are glad that you are here and that you signed up to take part. And this is your podcast as well. We want to hear from you. So in the Q&A section down there, please list any questions that you may have for all of my colleagues and reporters that they're here to listen and answer and share their perspective. So thank you and welcome for being here. When we come back, we're going to hear from our other WABE colleagues about bills that they were watching this session. I'm Lisa Ram, and this is the Gold Dome Scramble.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
We want to welcome you again to the Gold Dome Scramble. Right now, we're going to bring in education reporter Martha Dalton. Martha, welcome. We are glad that you're here. It was a great session, would you say, for education?
Well, it certainly was a busy one. Yes. Mm-hmm. I would say it was a win for educators. Mm-hmm. So there were a couple of big bills that I'm sure we'll get to that passed that educators are happy about and parents are happy about.
Well, go into some of those. Okay. Were there any real big surprises, first of all?
I don't know if this would count as a big surprise necessarily, but it was definitely a controversial one. The special needs voucher expansion bill, this was Senate Bill 47. Mm-hmm. Now, Georgia, the lawmakers introduced three different school voucher bills. This was the only one that made it. This was the only one that was approved. And it would expand the existing program. Georgia already has two voucher programs. This one's for students with special needs. And basically what it would do is sort of broaden the eligibility, make it a little easier to qualify for the voucher. And the voucher would be the amount that the state would normally spend on the child's education. So depending on where you live, it would be about $6,000 or so. To be able to put toward private school education. There are a lot of reasons why vouchers in general are controversial. Usually the sort of big overarching controversy is, should we be using public money to pay for private schools? You know, that's usually the big sort of sticking point. Mm-hmm. This one, there were a couple of different sticking points. That was one of them. The other one is that in order to accept the voucher, students will have to agree to forfeit some of the protections that they would get under federal law if they stayed in public schools. So they have these special needs, and under federal law, public schools have to provide certain accommodations for them. But if they accept this voucher to go to a private school, they have to agree to forfeit that, basically. So we actually have George Ray with the Georgia Education Coalition talking about that reason for his organization opposing the bill. Here's that audio.
This legislation will require the waiver of student protections and accommodations that are provided under federal law. Those are real rights enforceable by real administrative processes and access to the courts if they're not fulfilled. Those go away when students accept these scholarships.
Martha, I was hoping to jump in here and just ask you, you know, what do you think happened that allowed this to pass this year? I feel like voucher legislation has been foiled in the past, even with, you know, top Republican support.
Right. And those other two bills were, right? They didn't really go anywhere. So I think, you know, there has been a lot of attention on students with special needs during the pandemic and how hard remote learning has been for them. And I think it came down to, you know, these are kids with specific needs. This isn't, a general expansion of voucher programs across the state. This is one specific program for a specific group of kids. And I think that's what it came down to. You know, it had support from Democrats and Republicans. You know, generally Republicans are pushing voucher bills and Democrats oppose them, but it didn't pass cleanly along party lines. You know, there are still some bipartisan support, some bipartisan opposition. So it's one of those things where I think because there was so much attention on that issue, and because it was for such a specific group of students, mm-hmm. You know, what the term you often hear is our most vulnerable students, right. You know, the ones who were sort of in the most need of support. I think that's what eventually got it through, but it did just, it barely, when it started out in the Senate, it squeaked by in committee by 2 votes. So there was still, you know, it still wasn't an overwhelming passage, but I think, you know, just, it was sort of right place, right time.
Right time. Yeah, and you know, what lawmakers do affect people. And Martha, you're very in tune with the school system, with teachers and parents. What were parents feeling about this? You know, the lack of federal protection. It's an old argument, as you said, but are parents applauding this overall at this point?
Yeah, it really depends which parents you ask, but parents for whom the program has worked, obviously there, you know, a lot of them came to testify and came to speak in support of the bill and say, you know, my child has really benefited from this. Mm-hmm. This is something that has worked for our family. It can also kind of depend where you live in the state, because not every region of the state has a private school that will accept the vouchers. So you may have a child with a specific need, but in order to get them to a private school that can really help address that need, you may have to drive for an hour, you know, to get them there. So there is still a question of equity. But, you know, I think for a lot of parents who the program has worked for are very much in support of it. It just kind of depends on who you ask.
So a good start. This is a good start to helping those.
I think it just sort of, it depends on where you stand, you right. know, on the issue. There are some people who are just firmly against spending any public money
right.
to private schools. But I think for those who have had really good outcomes, you know, it's kind of hard to argue with that. And one thing I should point out about Georgia's voucher programs is that even though, you know, one of the big arguments is that the voucher amount of, you know, depending on where you live, $6,000, maybe $8,000, won't cover the full cost of private school tuition at most schools, but the vouchers are stackable. So if you right. qualify for the special needs voucher and then you take advantage of the other tax credit voucher program, you could potentially get about, you know, again, depending on where you live, $12,000 or so, which is a lot more to go toward the cost of full tuition. So,
well, as you know, Martha, money talks, and education getting a nice chunk of money this round, and just to offset some cuts that were made last year. What, 60%? Can expound on that and how that will help make up the difference.
You know? Right, right. I think it's important to remind people that last year, you know, at the very beginning of the pandemic, lawmakers cut almost $1 billion from K through 12 education. So that's sort of looming over this session, right? And now this budget will restore, like you said, Lisa, roughly 60% of that. So that's good news for educators. Of course, they'd love to see the full amount restored. Mm-hmm. Again, depending on who you talk to, it's either a great move or it's just not enough, right? But what will really help school districts this year is the federal help that they're going to get from the American Rescue Plan. The CARES money last year, CARES 1, CARES 2, really helped a lot of districts and helped them balance their budgets. And in this ARP, the latest stimulus package, a lot of districts in Metro Atlanta, or some districts, I should say, in Metro Atlanta will get about 4 times as much as they did with the first round of CARES funding. So that's really going to help schools a lot. That federal money has also helped to pay for $1,000 bonuses for all school employees in the state of Georgia. And that was just approved by the Board of Education. So that's good news for teachers too.
Yeah, always good news. Good news for Governor Kemp, the teacher pipeline legislation passed.
Right. Right. This was championed by Governor Kemp. The idea is to get more teachers into the profession. There was a 2015 survey done by the State Department of Education saying that almost half in Georgia left within 5 years. So what this would do is it would sort of charge HBCUs with coming up with innovative ways of recruiting more teachers, especially more teachers of color. It would also make it easier for veterans to become certified teachers. And and it would do some other little things like changing teacher evaluations and focusing a little bit more on reading instruction. So this was a win for the governor too.
All right. Any other highlights in terms of education that you want to tell us about? Because there was a whole lot of action, like you said, got overshadowed by the voting law.
There was one more bill I wanted to mention that was separate from the governor's teacher pipeline legislation, but it's along the same theme, which is a tax credit bill. It would give teachers a $3,000 tax credit to move to either teach at one of the lowest performing schools in the state or a rural area. So that one passed pretty easily too.
Martha, thank you so much for bringing us up to date. Stick with us because we got a Q&A session coming up. Want to get Molly and Sam in here as well. Molly, are you standing by there? Molly had some breaking news. Good to see you. We knew you were going to dash away and hopefully be back.
Yeah, here.
Yeah, your time is up. There was some breaking news before we get to all the legislation that happened regarding the environment and energy. Breaking news regarding the water wars that you have been covering. How many years have you been covering this now?
Well, I've been covering it for about 7 years because that's how long I've been at WABE, but it goes back 30 years. So
yes, it does.
I think it's good job security for me.
Well, good news for Georgia today, right? Good news for Georgia?
Yeah, big news today for Georgia. The U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion basically siding with Georgia in this case itself has been going on since 2013. Florida had asked the U.S. Supreme Court to cap Georgia's water use, to basically limit Georgia's water use. And the court issued its opinion today, dismissing the case, which means that's not going to happen. It's definitely being treated as a big victory here in Georgia. And I talked to Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr earlier today. And here's what he said his takeaway was from this.
Georgia's water use has been fair and it has been reasonable. And we're going to continue to be good stewards of our water resources. And we are just very, very proud to have obtained a positive resolution to this years-long dispute on behalf of all Georgians.
But Molly, this isn't the end, right?
I was going to say, does this mean it's over? It's not over.
No, it can't be the end. We've had it for so long. Don't worry, you all. It's not over. No, so this was, you know, this is a big opinion and a big important case for this. But there's actually two other cases still ongoing over water between Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. And then there's sort of also just this big question hanging over all of it, which is that, you know, we're arguing over these water resources at the same time as water regimes are changing. We're seeing more drought, we're seeing heavier precipitation. Mm-hmm. And so climate change is just going to make all of this more complicated going forward. So there will be, this is not the end. We'll be talking about it a lot more.
Any indication what it'll take to end this conversation? A lot, probably.
A lot. I mean, you know, a lot of advocates I talk to and water experts say that litigation is not the way to solve it, that people really need to just, you know, take this out of the courts and find a deal. And there has been a group called the Apalachicola Chattahoochee Flint Stakeholders, which are people from all three of the states that have been fighting over the river. And they came up with a plan that they said they could all agree on, a way to share the water. Gosh, it was 5 years ago or so. It kind of didn't go anywhere because the Supreme Court case was happening. But, you know, I think folks involved with it still say, like, look, we can work this out. It doesn't have to be lawsuits finding a way to solve this. Mm-hmm. That all being said, there are still these other lawsuits happening. And we, you know, who knows, we could see more going forward. So hopefully there's a solution. Don't know.
7 years and counting, right? Okay, let's get to the legislature. A lot going on with natural gas. Let's begin there.
Yeah, so this was one bill that I followed that did pass this year, and it similar to other bills around the country that we're seeing in other states around the country, and it was inspired by cities like Berkeley, California, mm-hmm. that are banning new natural gas connections in an effort to address climate change. So, you know, new homes or buildings being built, that they would not have a natural gas connection, they would be all electric. So the natural gas industry is really pushing bills that ban those natural gas bans. It's a, you know, preemption bill essentially, and that passed here in Georgia
this year. So cities like Atlanta and Savannah had sort of been arguing, like, please don't do this. They weren't trying to pass this ban, but they just didn't want to be limited in how they address climate change. Environmental groups were fighting this, but the bill did pass.
One issue that got a lot of chatter, and you've done the stories on this, is coal ash. Can bring us up to date there, maybe give our listeners a brief background and where we stand with coal ash.
Yes. So the background of what is coal ash is it is a byproduct from. So it's a byproduct from burning coal for electricity. And so, you know, maybe if you have a charcoal grill and you can maybe kind of picture this, there's ash left over at the end. So coal-fired power plants produce this on a very large, gigantic scale. We're talking tens of millions of tons. And so Georgia Power and other utilities following rules from the EPA several years ago now, are cleaning up their coal ash ponds. But there's still a lot of disagreement about the safest way to do that, the most secure way to store coal ash. And so we've seen various bills in lots of sessions going back, weighing in to store it more securely, to track it for longer term. No coal ash bills passed this year. There were two introduced, one backed by Democrats that would have required more secure storage of coal ash long term. They had introduced the same bill last year. It didn't get a committee hearing, and it didn't get a committee hearing this year either. Another was a GOP-backed bill that would have required longer term monitoring and also some clearer communication. And that did get a committee hearing, but did not end up passing.
Well, clearly, cleanup is important. What's stalling this? What do you think the holdup is?
Cleanup is important. It's also very expensive. Mm-hmm. And the Georgia Public Service Commission, they're right across the street from the State House, you know, they've approved a lot of Georgia Power's expenses for coal ash cleanup will actually be on Georgia Power customers' power bills that consumers will be covering it. So I think it's just, you know, it's been this long fight about what's the safest way to do it. There's disagreement between officials, the utilities, and environmental advocates, mm-hmm. And who's going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, two big ones you still have to cover, coal ash and water. So you've got your work cut out for you. Before we end here, Molly, with your segment here, I understand we finally have a new state nut that isn't a nut. So give us the explainer on that.
Molly's public service campaign.
So glad you asked, Lisa. So we are on our way to having an official state nut. It is the pecan. The Georgia lawmakers supporting this bill have been careful to mention that the peanut industry is not upset about this because peanuts are already Georgia's official state crop. Mm-hmm. But pecans technically are drupes, which are a fruit. I think, you know, lots of us, you know, if you're just going to the grocery store, I would say I'm just going to go buy some nuts and get some pecans. So I'm not going to be a hardcore stickler on this, but just FYI, pecans are drupes.
That's going to be the major takeaway from this.
Yes.
Yeah. Molly, don't go anywhere. We've got tons of questions coming in, and we promise we're going to get to you in a moment, but we've got to get in Sam Whitehead, our health reporter. Sam, you standing by there? He is the host of our podcast, Did You Wash Your Hands? And he's been keeping track of health-related bills in the legislature. Sam, welcome. And you doing a fantastic job with the COVID and the coronavirus. What are state lawmakers doing to attack that? Did they wind up with anything? You know, we got the federal support, but what about the state? Where are they?
Yeah, so a lot of this really came to play in the state budget, right? You might think that going into, you know, January, cases were spiking here in the state and around the country, that Georgia lawmakers might want to throw some scratch to our public health system. It turns out that was not necessarily the case. So there wasn't a ton of money in the state budget this year for our state public health department. They gave about $1 million to give that agency a few new kind of like C-suite level positions, a chief medical officer, a chief data officer. And part of the reason why is just because of how much federal money has really come into the state to fund its COVID response. Mostly federal dollars funding Georgia's COVID response. I checked in with the department today. The latest total is $1.1 billion to do everything like pay for extra lab capacity, the vaccine rollout, and just kind of their general, you know, epidemiological work, contact tracing. And so, you know, I think understanding that our state house is still run by a bunch of Republicans for the most part, why would they allocate state dollars when all of this federal money is coming in?
Well, I'll just say that looking at the budget, Lisa, all the way up and down, I mean, we heard Martha talk about it. This was such a theme. It's like the official language is recognizing federal funds, recognizing this, recognizing that. It was all through the budget. I mean, this relief plan had a multi-billion dollar effect on it.
And yeah, it is a cushion, but it's a cushion that's going to go away. And that's what I'm really interesting to watch down the road. Say, for example, during the pandemic, the federal government has given states more money for their Medicaid programs. So those are programs that are funded partially by state dollars and partially by federal dollars. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of enhanced match that states are getting. But that's not permanent. It's been extended under the Biden administration from what the Trump administration put into place. But that's going to dry up at some point. And so what I'm really curious to see down the road is, as Emma mentioned, state lawmakers realizing all of these federal dollars coming in the door, they're going to stop at some point. And I think there's this big question of what happens then.
In the state budget, there's a chunk set aside for mental health. Why was that such a priority, do you think?
You know, this has been something that lawmakers have focused on for years, and I think for a few reasons. I mean, there is, I think, just this growing understanding that the mental health needs of Georgians are real and acute. I think that goes with, you know, society at large realizing that, you know, mental health is just as important as physical health in a lot of ways. And, you know, we've seen that in the budget process before. Georgia's state agency that works with people with mental health conditions tends to be one that has lawmakers go to bat for it the most, because it's also something that they can really take home to their constituents and say, we know that you're struggling with mental health issues or substance abuse issues, things that have only been exacerbated by the pandemic.
Right.
And here is what we are doing to make sure that you have the services you need.
Another pandemic-related bill that state lawmakers did tackle was the visit to nursing home, and that was near and dear to a lot of people in our state.
Yeah, this one has been really tough because, you know, I think for everyone who's had a family member in a long-term care facility during the pandemic, or even a family member who's been hospitalized with anything, not necessarily just COVID, these are settings that have really been closed because of the pandemic, right? So if you have a parent or a grandparent in a long-term care facility, for months and months, those facilities were closed to the public. And, you know, that goes beyond just being able to pay your family member a visit to keep them company, you know, once every week. Families are really some of the strongest advocates for people who are in these settings because, you know your mother, you know how your mother is normally. And if you go see her one Sunday and she doesn't seem right, you're going to then go talk to the facility staff and say, what's up? And so, you know, I think there was a lot of concern about what is happening to people in these settings when their family members can't go visit them, right? So lawmakers proposed this bill. The takeaway was that a patient representative, so a family member, we'll say, would be able to go into a long-term care facility or a hospital for 1 hour that they would have access. And so hospitals and nursing homes were concerned about this because these are healthcare professionals who want to keep their staff and other patients safe. And so there was a lot of pushback from, you know, the hospital lobby, we'll say, which is very powerful down at the state house, and from other lawmakers who said, we're legislating for a problem now that is going to put into code language that might not apply to the next public health emergency.
Right.
So this made it out of the House after some very emotional testimony. In the Senate, it kind of got gutted. And then there was some kind of final back and forth yesterday where the House tried to restore the language, and then it just seemed like the Senate didn't have the energy to get to it yesterday, so it eventually just kind of fizzled.
But this was really near and dear to House Speaker David Ralston, right, who gave some emotional testimony.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's near and dear to a lot of people. I mean, I can say I had family members who were hospitalized in the last year, and it's tough. It's like really personally tough to not be able to go and see them. But I think what's also happened, Lisa, is that the pandemic situation has evolved, and some of the federal regulation that dictate these kinds of settings have evolved, has evolved too. You know, cases are in a much different place than they were in the beginning of January when lawmakers were, you know, first looking into this. And even over the course of the session, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they're the federal agency that really plays a strong role in regulating nursing homes. They opened up visitation in a way that it hadn't been opened before. And so, you know, it's not too surprising to me that lawmakers were maybe not so interested in this come sine die yesterday, because just the ground truth had changed so much.
All right. Well, it is ever changing. It seems to be, as you well know, that we're getting on the other side of this pandemic. Are there any other health-related bills that kind of snuck through and that are going to make its way to the governor for signature?
Yeah, I think a really big one that made it through early on is going to have a really big impact on uninsured kids here in Georgia. So one estimate from the folks up at Georgetown says about 7% of all kids in Georgia are uninsured, and that's a lot of kids. And so what this bill does is it sets up a, you know, so-called express lane. So if you are a child in Georgia who receives SNAP benefits or food stamps, you will automatically be kind of run through the system to see if you would qualify for Peach Care for Kids, which is our child Medicaid program. And this is something that had some bipartisan support. And, you know, it's one of these things that it's an easy way for the state to be able to help, you know, low-income families. And so I think, you know, I would be surprised if the governor didn't sign this. But that, of course, is something the state would still have to apply for federal approval. And then just one more thing, and I'll leave us on this. For COVID, lawmakers early on in the session extended liability protections for businesses, essentially saying you as an individual can't sue a business if you think you got exposed to the coronavirus there. Those protections were set to sunset this summer, and they've been extended until July of next year.
You consider this a winning session for healthcare?
I mean, I think Emil started with it. I was convinced that the State House was going to be ground central for a COVID outbreak. and so, I mean, and it's
that's something to celebrate.
It is. And, you know,
following guidelines works, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it has been, we saw some really strong language from Speaker Ralston early in the session. He really chastised lawmakers for not taking advantage of the testing system set up by Georgia Tech down there. But, you know, it's no surprise that a lot of our state lawmakers are not spring chickens. And, you know, I frankly have not been down there a lot myself just because I was concerned. But, you know, I think like so much else in the pandemic, this is something that going into it, you know, I'm thinking about schools. We all thought schools were going to be ground zero. Mm-hmm. We got lucky that they haven't been. And I think we got very lucky that the session was able to finish in 40 days, as long as I'm sure they felt to Emil and Emma.
Yeah. Sam, thank you so much. We've got 10 minutes left, so I'm going to quickly get to the questions. Martha, Molly, can you join us again? Because we've got some that maybe you two can address as well. John Guy, And whoever feels comfortable taking this, what happened with the standard daylight time change bills? Emil, did you cover that a little bit?
Yeah, I did. And it was interesting that at one point there were kind of competing measures in the House and the Senate. Both wanted to do away with switching the daylight saving time switch. One wanted to go with just daylight saving time. The other one wanted to go with just standard time. And what ended up happening is the House won out. And so pending congressional approval, this is something that state lawmakers can't do on their own. They have got to get congressional approval from Washington to switch to full-time daylight saving time. And there were all sorts of arguments about the health benefits and all the scientific studies that have gone into that switch that we make twice a year. So in the not too distant future, we could see Georgia just stick with one time throughout the course of the year.
And again, it needs federal approval, right?
It does, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. David Deitch, is the voting law going to follow the same path as the abortion law, getting a lot of media attention up front, but then a judge will issue a stay of and then it will fall off the radar?
I will say, as someone who follows the abortion lawsuit, that is not off my radar.
Right, right.
Because, you know, just this week, the state, of course, you know, appealed a district court ruling. Now it's before the Court of Appeals. So our state is still defending that law in court. And, you know, I think it might fall off the radar when there's not hearings, but that's also like state dollars going to defend those laws. So maybe a caveat before I let one of our other people jump in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question, and it's very much an open one. I talked to some of the plaintiffs in some of these suits this week, as well as, you know, other lawyers who are maybe kind of skeptical of whether they can prove standing, right? That's the big question is, can you prove that there's been injury when there hasn't been an election yet? There hasn't been an election. This law isn't been technically applied. Mm-hmm. So that's really the question that the court is going to decide first before mm-hmm. we see how long it drags out. If the court says, no, there's been no election, we don't have enough data to mm-hmm. back up your complaint, then it'll end quickly. But if it doesn't, it could certainly drag out, and it could certainly affect future elections in terms of the law being held up.
Right.
And you'll also see, just sort of quickly say, you also see the question of undue burden. Does this put an undue burden on people who don't have access to state-issued photo ID, or someone who doesn't have access to go to the polls during hours in which they have, or go to a Dropbox site during hours in which you can now drop off your ballot? And so you'll see that question come up a lot as we go toward the elections of 2022, and to see if perhaps a preliminary injunction is imposed.
All right, let's get one more question in as time winds down. Sam, you may want to kick this conversation off. What is the status of the federal government putting on hold approval of the state attempt at Medicare expansion?
Yeah, so Medicaid expansion is tricky, right? We could do a whole session on this. So the state of Georgia a few years ago passed something called the Patients First Act, which was Governor Kemp's kind of conservative approach to a Medicaid expansion. This would be a limited expansion with a work requirement. And the Trump administration was all for it. The Trump administration was really big that work should be a requirement for Medicaid in general, but the Trump administration is not in the White House anymore. And so the Biden administration has come in and said, well, no, we don't actually think that should be a requirement for you to get this health coverage. So that is currently in limbo. We are waiting to see what the Biden administration does, whether or not they revoke Georgia's plan, which had been approved. And we're expecting that decision at some point soon. I think the other part of this conversation is the American Rescue Plan, this big COVID relief package that Biden and his team got through Congress, includes a lot of incentives for states like Georgia that have yet to fully expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act to do so. There are about a dozen, you know, a lot of big red states, Texas, Florida. And there have been some estimates that this could save Georgia something like $2 billion if the state were to do it. but Georgia's left lots of money on the table before. So I'm hard pressed to imagine that, you know, while we have a, you know, thoroughly Republican legislature and Republican governor, I have a hard time imagining that's going to go anywhere.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Before we run out of time, we got about 3.5 minutes left. Molly, the session's over, but what might you be watching that lawmakers may pick up next round?
Full Ash again?
Yeah. At least you can laugh about it. Martha, how about you, education?
Well, a bill that almost made it through this year that didn't quite get there would have helped out Dreamers or DACA students, kids who are brought to this country as children who are not citizens with college tuition. It came pretty close to getting a vote in the House, but just didn't get there. I think that'll come up again next year.
All right. And Emma, this summer, something may come up regarding what? Redistricting, something like that?
Yeah, that's the next thing. I don't know. You guys might be hearing from us sooner than you thought, because there will be another session in the fall sometime. We don't know when, because we're waiting for the census data, which was delayed by the pandemic. But there will be a whole session dedicated to lawmakers redrawing their own district lines. And this is a really intense moment for the legislature. I've never covered one myself before, but I hear it gets pretty brutal, because not everybody's going to make it. Not everybody's district is going to stay. Not everyone's going to be able to get reelected in their districts. And so there's the horse trading, but then there's also kind of like people trading here, because you're saying, I'm going to have to write you out, my friend. I'm sorry. So that's coming up. Stay tuned.
All right, we will stay tuned. And Emil, can you end letting our listeners know, you know, where things go from here? A lot of bills are going to end up on Governor Kemp's desk, but he may not sign them all. Any vetoes that you're predicting at this point?
It seems like a lot of the legislation that he had opposed or voiced skepticism on didn't get to his desk eventually, or is not going to get to his desk because it wasn't passed during the session. So I think a lot of the things that the lawmakers did pass, he will end up signing. He also has the option of not doing anything and letting them just become law, or he could, as you mentioned, veto a law if he doesn't like it. He has 40 days to decide. A lot of laws go into effect July 1st. Some will go into effect January 1st. The election bill will go into effect January 1st. But, you know, as Sam mentioned, I'm talking about trying to legislate to the current pandemic. You also saw that a little bit with the chief labor officer of the labor department, where there's such a backlog of unemployment claims, and really how do you address that right away as a legislature? I think they kind of were able to send up some alarm bells and say, hey, you know, the Department of Labor is doing as best as they can, but they need to produce more, not only to get people their unemployment checks, but also to report to the state so that it doesn't lose its AAA bond rating as well. So I think they have kind of made some noise in trying to get some things done there from the Department of Labor in the state.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all. The end is here. We're a minute out. Do y'all have papers? You want to throw them up in the air? And we can say our own signy die right now.
I found some papers. I found a real newspaper.
Thank you all for joining us. That's it for our live edition of the Gold Dome Scramble. We now turn to our virtual live audience to say thank you, thank you, thank you for supporting all these wonderful journalists through this long session. And thank you for being here tonight. We'll see you again next session or maybe this summer. Who knows? Have a great evening.
Thank you all.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.